Well, thank you all for attending, and welcome once again. Thanks, Kim, for getting us started today. As veterans, you all know how critical your participation is to the success of NACEP and our accreditation process, and how important our accreditation process has been to the success of the organization and the success of concurrent enrollment around the country. It has been something that has been a source of very positive reputation for NACEP as an organization and continues to build our footprint around the country as our accreditation process grows. We are going to try our best today, since everyone on here but Lori is a veteran, we're going to try our best to focus in on some of the issues that are maybe sort of more of the thornier and challenging issues that you'll encounter, and try to at least sort of I don't want to say gloss over, but go through quickly the kind of basics of things, since most of you on this call have been reviewers beforehand. Please do, what we will do is at the end of each cluster of standards, so in the curriculum standards, the assessment standards, we'll take a few minutes for some dialogue. So if there are particular issues that you've encountered as peer reviewers previously, that you think are worth kind of discussing and raising, things that are have been a little bit more challenging to sort through, please do go ahead and raise them. It's a good opportunity for a number of our more experienced reviewers to really delve into some of the more meaty issues. Just wanted to update you on a few things. As you all know, the Accreditation Commission was created last year and had a very successful first review cycle. The commission was formed right at the start of the last review cycle. And so really we ran last year's review cycle very similar to as we had run it previously. But we found last spring in April, when the commission got together to deliberate on the final decisions regarding the accreditation applications, we really found that it was a valuable experience for an 8-member body to sit and review the reports from the peer review teams, review the reports from the coordinating commissioner who had been assigned to as a liaison to each application, and give each application the time and thought that it needed, and that the decisions were really expanded across a pool of individuals rather than really resting very strongly in the one accreditation committee chair, which is the previous model that we had done. We had found in recent years that by the time it reached the board of directors really had very little information as it was making the final decisions in the past. And so now by introducing the Accreditation Commission, we've found that to be a really valuable opportunity for a deliberative body to delve into sometimes some of the stickier issues when, let's say, an application is strong in 15 of the 17 standards, but is really on the cusp on the remaining two. And so I think that's one thing that you'll be hearing more from your commissioner this year. We have most of our commissioners are returning this year. We just have one that's turned over, one position that's turned over. And so as they've gotten more comfortable with the process as it's emerging, we're in the process of adopting a policy and procedure guide for the commission, which we'll be sharing with you all when we make a little further progress on it. But that will, again, clarify some of the expectations of the review process that in the past have been sort of undocumented or documented in multiple places. As you know, above all, our main goal for you is to treat this peer review process with professionalism. And please do feel free to chime in with messages on the chat window if you have any questions or comments as we're going along. As you know, since all of you have been seen this before, applications take an incredible amount of time and effort to put together. Many of our institutions are taking this process, as a very significant step for their institution to improve the quality of their programs. And so this is a high-stakes decision for many people. And we do ask that you take your role seriously and treat the entire process with professionalism. One of the things that has changed this year with regards to confidentiality is the Accreditation Commission has decided that it will begin publishing the names of programs that are undergoing application review. As we studied the review processes of other accrediting bodies around, we found that we were outside of the typical practice with regards to transparency. And so we've notified the applicants that this year they will be, the name of their institution will be listed on the NACEF website. So that is one thing that is no longer a confidential aspect. That being said, we don't want you to go around and advertise that I am, you know, I'm serving on the peer review team for X, Y, and Z college. Really, you know, that is an internal confidentiality. But that the names of the colleges themselves will be published for the first time this year. We will ask you once again to sign a conflict of interest statement. We will send that out to you. It's a peer reviewer agreement, and it talks about the various types of conflicts, either real or perceived, that you may have that would prohibit you from serving as a peer reviewer on that particular application. Please do let us know if we assign you to an application for which you may have a real or perceived stake in the outcome, and if that's the case, we'll go ahead and reassign you to a different application. We do ask that if you are serving as a consultant for concurrent enrollment programs, if you are earning money through direct professional technical assistance to other concurrent enrollment programs, we ask that you do step down as a peer reviewer during the term of your consulting work, because we do want to keep the peer review process held to the highest standards. Just some logistics again. Most of you are familiar with this. We do have a conference call line that is available to your peer review teams, and if you need to use that line, just go ahead and contact our office. Tanisha Langhorn has been scheduling that conference call line for us. Many of you have interacted with her over the last year or two. She's actually leaving us later this summer. She's moving to Atlanta, and so we will be hiring a new person in the office who will have that responsibility moving forward. But for now, feel free to contact me, Kim, or Tanisha to schedule the conference call line. We will certainly give you the new contact information when we have our new staff person on board. We do utilize this file sharing service called Box, and what this service allows is for password-protected storage of accreditation applications. The applicants have uploaded their applications to the website, and it is, as I'll get to the next page, organized in a standard fashion. The easiest way for you as peer reviewers to access the information is to go ahead and download the entire folder to your local hard drive. We find that creates the least number of technical difficulties. It is possible to do some limited amount of viewing files online, but the formatting doesn't always work properly that way, and it can be quite slow when you think about the number of files that are contained in an application. So we suggest that as soon as you receive the link, you go ahead and download it. It may take a little while to download, but once it's downloaded to your hard drive, then you've got easy access to all the files. It will come in a compressed format, a zip format it's referred to as. Both Windows and Mac can decompress zip file folders. And some people have specialized software as well installed on their computers. All the files should be in pretty commonly readable formats, such as Acrobat, Word, Excel, and PowerPoint. And if you encounter any difficulties opening any files, certainly do let us know, and we'll try and help you troubleshoot that. But ideally, by the time it reaches you, it should be very clearly in formats you can read. This is the required folder structure that all applicants have been asked to utilize. And the structure, for those of you who've been doing it for a while, as Dennis and Sandy said, this structure has changed a little bit over the years. This is the same structure that was in place last year. We do ask that the applicants don't include copies of documents multiple times, but instead they put them in the most relevant folder and then reference, if needed, a file. And in particular, paired syllabi should all be in one folder. Paired assessments should all be in one folder within the A1 and the A3 folders, respectively. At the heart of the accreditation process is really program improvement. We consider the self-study phase before an application is prepared is really when we expect colleges and universities to take a long, hard look at their program and see how they can improve it. Every program has areas where it's strong, and every program has areas where there's opportunity for improvement. And so throughout the self-study process, programs compile considerable amounts of evidence, both documenting their practices, but ideally during that build-up to the actual accreditation application, whether it's an initial application or a reaccreditation, that they have gone through a thoughtful process reflecting upon the strengths of their program and ensuring that they've implemented things consistently across all disciplines in that the college offers concurrent enrollment courses for. That being said, while one of the primary goals is program improvement, the accreditation review itself is evaluative. It is an assessment of whether or not the standards are in place and not an assessment of what the plans are for future implementation of the standards. All practice and policies must be in place at the time of application. And so as veterans, I think one of the things that you often will notice is there are sometimes a few areas where things are solidly in place in advance and then a few things were hurriedly put in place right before an application is put together. So, you know, I think one of the things you can help provide on the teams in which you serve is that sort of ground truthing in terms of, all right, you know, this is 95% in place, and, you know, that in remaining 5%, how critical was it that was all in place as of July 1, or is that, you know, final 1 or 2 or 3%, you know, is that one missing site visit, you know, that they managed to do after the July 1st deadline? How critical is this to the holistic perspective of an application? Because we are accrediting an entire program and it is across all 17 standards, you know, this does need to be looked at from a holistic perspective. While you may find if you went through the fine-tooth comb like an auditor and pulled selective files here and there, and you might find, you know, one or two areas that would be, let's say, out of compliance. But the question is, from a holistic perspective, is this application, is this program being operated in a way that is consistent with the standards? And I think that's one of the things as veterans that you can really contribute to a peer review team. With reaccreditation applications, since many of you are looming upon this yourselves or have recently gone through it yourselves, we treat reaccreditation applications very similar to how we treat initial accreditation applications. The evidence that is being evaluated is whether or not the program is meeting the standards at the time of the application. And so the vast majority of the evidence is going to be from the prior academic year, even for reaccreditation applications. And so you know, that is one thing to be aware of, is we're not evaluating how well a program has implemented the standards over the prior seven-year period. It is really at the time at which they're applying for reaccreditation, are they meeting the standards at this point in time, just as it is with an initial accreditation as well. In terms of the structure, as I mentioned before, last year we inaugurated the NACIP Accreditation Commission, this 8-member body, some of which are elected, some of which are appointed. It involves representatives from private universities, it involves public colleges, community colleges, as well as four-year universities. So we've got a diverse range of perspectives. We've got small programs and large programs represented on the commission, rural and urban. So just as with the diversity of institutions that apply for our accreditation, that is reflected on the commission as well. Coordinating commissioner, each of the applications has been assigned to one of the eight accreditation commissioners. Their role is to be a liaison between the commission and your peer review team. Each peer review team will have a team leader who will be the one primarily responsible for organizing phone calls, for ensuring that all the members of the team have reviewed the application and contribute their input and advice. And generally speaking, are the ones who are drafting up the commentary and the like. Some teams choose to have a recorder, someone who's going to take notes. It's separate from the peer review team leader. Sometimes that is the review team leader. It's just depending on how you choose to organize. We do ask that you involve the commissioner throughout the process, so please let them know when you're having your conference calls so that they can join in and hear your concerns, hear the issues that you're identifying, and be available as a resource to you if you have any questions and points of clarification for which their input would be helpful. They will, over the course of the review, be reviewing all the evidence that you review as well as also the report that your team puts together. And so it's important that they become as familiar as possible with this application as well. Jacqueline and Kathleen have been having a bit of a dialogue on here that about reaccreditation, and so I'll just point you to your chat window there to see some commentary about that, and perhaps a little later on, if we've got time towards the end, we can talk a little further about that as a group as needed. I'm going to turn it over now to Kim to talk about the timeline.
Thanks, Adam. Okay, so on this first slide, you can see that now the coordinating commissioner screening is underway. In a few weeks, in mid-August, all applications will be assigned to teams, and at that point, you will find out whether you've been accepted to be a peer reviewer when we assign you an application. And then, you know, by September, teams are having their first call to discuss standard by standard, and then by October, you would go back to those applicants to request additional evidence. So that's the speed version of kind of the first few steps. The goal of the screening that's going on right now is to make sure that the application is ready for you to review and includes all the relevant documents that you will need, that all the links work, all the files are organized appropriately. Just because a commissioner passes on an application to you as a peer review team does not indicate that a program is accreditable. They've not done a substantive review of all the evidence. So do not presume that because you're getting an applicant, it means that it is all set. So between when you get your application and October, the goal at this stage is to identify any deficiencies and determine what information your team needs to make a final decision. You should make sure that you read through all the application materials prior to your phone call with your peer review team and be prepared to discuss the evidence that was provided for each standard. For any phone calls that you have, please include the coordinating commissioner on them so that they will be aware of any issues that your team identifies with the application. Understand that it might take more than one call to go through all 17 standards. Even if you detect significant shortcomings, your team should not recommend denial or withdrawal to an applicant at this point in the process. All applicants must be given the chance to go through the interview process and respond to your initial review before we make a recommendation. The team leader requests clarification or additional documentation from the applicant prior to the interview and will ensure that all team members and the coordinating commissioner receive all submitted information. Please remember to copy the coordinating commissioner and Adam on all substantive communication with the applicant. moving to the next slide. Okay, so all applicants who are attending the annual NACEP conference are expected to participate in an interview with the peer review team and the coordinating commissioner. If the applicant or the peer review team are not at the conference, then they will conduct this interview at a later date. It's critical that applicants receive your initial request for additional evidence prior to this interview. So after you have your phone call with your team and identify the shortcomings in the application, at that point you need to make sure that you request clarification and additional documentation from the applicant before these interviews take place. At the end of that interview, the program will include any additional information that was shared during the interview in its first response back to you, which, as you can see on the slide, should be by January 15th. So at that time, you should receive any requested information from them, either that was identified prior to your interviews at the conference or that was discussed at the interview at or following the conference in that teleconference period. You should discuss with your coordinator or the chair if the team has significant concerns with certain standards that are unlikely to be resolved with further review. It is better for such concerns to be raised early in the review. As needed, the chair might contact the applicant to discuss the viability of continuing the review. So if you do have significant concerns, please raise them early and don't wait until the very end. So following the first response from the applicant, you will have a second team call to discuss the additional evidence that you receive. On the second call, the review team will discuss the applicant's response and its impact on that application. At that point, the team will decide to recommend the coordinating commissioner and accreditation commission chair either to approve or deny the application for accreditation. Please do not notify the applicant of your recommendation. The accreditation commission chair will take care of all the notifications once the commission makes a final decision. The team might also decide that additional clarification or documentation is still necessary to make a final determination, and this could be the final request for additional evidence. So if that is the case, at that time, you will make a second and final request for additional evidence from the applicant, and then follow that up with a second and final response from the applicant if that is necessary. Once again, please remember to copy the coordinating commissioner and executive director on any of that communication with the applicants. Okay, and then last slide. So lastly, if that last request is necessary, you would have an additional call to discuss the new information that you've received from the applicant. And then we will get back to you with a date for when that final report is due to the coordinating commissioner and chair. Last year was at the very beginning of April, so it will most likely be around the same time. And then by May 1st, the commission will meet in person to deliberate on all the accreditation decisions and vote to approve or deny accreditation. So I was just reading Kathleen's question. Can you explain how discussion is conducted when it may be recommended that the institution withdraw their application? I'm going to throw this to either Jacqueline or Adam.
Jacqueline, do you want to take it or should I?
I'll take it. So, Kathleen, I think it depends on the point at which it's realized that the application isn't ready to move forward. So there are a couple of places where that could happen. The first is during the screening process, which we are doing right now with the members of the commission. They're looking through the applications. They are not reviewing them, but sometimes in the process of screening, you can discover that a program doesn't really have all of the standards in place based on the evidence that they've submitted and the things, or not submitted as the case may be, and the things that they're saying in their cover sheets. And in that case, the commissioner contacts Adam and myself. We look through it as well and then kind of decide from there whether or not this looks like something that's viable or deserves a chance to move forward, or whether it's just going to be a waste of time for the review team to get this typically, you know, there, if you haven't put your best foot forward from the beginning, then that's not going to be very easy to do later on. The second place that we might have a recommendation for withdrawal is after the program has had an opportunity to respond to the first round of feedback. And at that point, the review team can make a recommendation to the coordinating commissioner that the application be withdrawn. At that point, then I, as the chair, contact that program and say, here's what has been recommended. And the program can choose to leave themselves in the pool and move before the commission for a vote at the end of the spring, or they can go ahead and withdraw their application and get some detailed feedback on what exactly the shortcomings were according to the review team, and then decide what to do from there. Does that answer your question? I know it's difficult because you can't talk back, but you can type back. So, and Adam, please jump in if I left anything out. There's also a whole process for people who want to, I guess, contest the recommendation, but that's something that we don't have to get to very often. Okay.
Yeah, I think the point is that ultimately any decision to withdraw an application rather than continue through the process is up to the applicant. And so peer review teams, if they are discovering early on in the process that there are some significant challenges with this application, please do make sure your commissioner, coordinating commissioner, is aware of that, and Jacqueline as well, so that they can have that conversation with the applicant if it seems that the opportunity for succeeding in the accreditation process is going to be very slim. If it looks like an accreditation is not going to make it through, as early as that's been identified as possible is helpful. I think in particular what we've found is that if an applicant is provided some early feedback, they've got time during that spring semester and the summer to implement some new things if they want to come back the following year. If it waits and drags out all the way till the very end, by the time the accreditation commission were to vote on an application in April, there's no time left for a program to do any changes in order to reapply that next year. So identifying those early as possible is useful. Dennis asks if a new team takes over. So yes, for those programs that reapply after having been unsuccessful 1 year, then we will convene a new accreditation peer review team. And likewise, if they were to appeal a decision or to ask for reconsideration, we would likewise convene a new peer review team to look at the evidence with fresh eyes.
I have to say that one of the benefits to you all of being reviewer under this new reign of having a commission instead of just a committee chair, a single individual, is that the commission is really there to protect you as a reviewer, so that if a program says, well, my gosh, I think we meet the standards and I can't believe these three people on a review team that I've now sat down with in person, you know, don't believe that. We as a commission can say, look, it's not up to the review team. You all do the bulk of the work. You review all the documents and you tell us what you think. But at the end of the day, it comes down to a vote of the commission. And we took that job very seriously. We spent hours locked in a room in a basement on a campus in St. Louis. so we weren't just out there having a good time, but we definitely took everything that the team said very seriously, and we spent hours deliberating. And I think that's important for you all to know that we're not going to throw you under the bus. We're not going to say, gosh, you're right. They, you know, whatever. We really want to make sure that we're all being very thorough with this process, and that the programs who are under review know that it's not just one person who's making this decision, or it's not just a team of three people who's making this decision, that there's a whole chain of people who are looking at these applications and deliberating and discussing these matters. And we had some really robust conversation. So I hope that makes you feel a little bit better that we're not just arbitrarily rubber stamping things, nor are we arbitrarily overturning things. So, alrighty, I think this is my slide, so I will let Kim and Adam handle the chat message from here. So again, most of you have reviewed before, and sorry, this is Jacqueline, Chair of the Accreditation Commission. I hopped in earlier without saying who you were hearing from. And so I do want to thank you all for serving as reviewers again. I know it's something that takes up a lot of time, especially in the fall when we are all busy doing our enrollments for our own programs. But I know that because you have been through it on the other side as an applicant, you know how valuable it is for that review team to give that time and to get the feedback from those folks. So thank you for putting that time back into the organization. So we've got a screenshot up here of the review form, and I just kind of wanted to spend a few minutes talking about it. We have added a few extra reporting layers at the end of the process. So if you were a reviewer in the 2013-14 cycle, you might know what I'm talking about. But I just wanted to tell you how important the review form is. This is not supposed to be a tool that goes between the review team and the program that's under review. It's really supposed to be an internal document for you personally as a reviewer, and then as you work together as a review team, one of you, whoever's serving as the recorder, and it's usually good for someone with a little more experience to be in that role, keeping track of the content of your conversations. And there are areas within the review form for you to do this. We've blocked it off. It's a Word document, so you can go in and type in the content of your first review call, your second review call, what were the areas of concern, and where did you ask for more information or additional evidence from the program. We looked at every single one of the teams last year. We asked them to submit a final review form so that we could see overall where did their conversation span on each of the standards. And so I just wanted you guys to know that we read those, and they were very, very helpful as we were making our deliberations. We would, we kind of poked around at the evidence. We didn't look at every single thing because, again, we were looking at, 15 programs, give or take, so we didn't have time for that level of scrutiny. But we would poke around and pull up a document or two and then say, wow, I wonder what the review team said about this. And then we could go back to your form, and we could see that you had discussed it and you had asked for additional information, and it was very, very helpful to see kind of the abbreviated version of your discussion. So I just want to encourage you to continue using that form if you feel like it works for you. If you have suggestions, please let us know. We always want to make it better for you, but at the end of the day, it is a lot of stuff that we're going through, and so there's going to be just some things that are going to be a little unwieldy in terms of it is like a 22-page document before you even start typing into it. So please make it your own. So the purpose of the review form, documenting, requesting evidence, and then organizing your notes so that when you get to that end of the review cycle, which is about 7-8 months down the road, I promise you, you will not remember the content of your conversation. So please do use this to document all of those things. When you ask the programs for additional information, we don't intend for this form to be what you send to that program. It's usually easiest if you just kind of type up in a short email format or short letter format, for this standard, we'd like to ask this, this, and this. Something new that you will notice this year on the review form is we've deliberately removed the bottom portion of each standard that says whether or not it has been met. There were previously check boxes that said this standard has been met, yes or no. And one thing that we have noticed is that it can lead to some hard feelings. If a program perceives that you have said, oh, this standard has been met, perhaps you've got a question on another standard, and then their answer raises a question about a standard that they previously thought was okay. We don't want to give the impression that, oh, you're 15/17 of the way through this thing. And we want us and you to have the freedom to go back and ask questions about any part of the application at any point in the process, and to not feel like you've been hampered by a checkbox. So that's why that was removed, and hopefully that will prove to be helpful to you as you move forward. Kim or Adam, next slide, please. So next is the program description. So now we're actually moving into the part where we look at what does the application itself look like and what's the evidence that we're looking for. So this is very similar to what you filled out as an applicant. The only issues might be, number one, if a program offers concurrent enrollment along with some other model that is not part of the NACEP definition. We do try to catch this, but it may slip through. So if somebody is offering articulated credit like Project Lead the Way, or if they're bringing students to campus and those numbers and definitions have been rolled into this application, that is a red flag, mostly just because we're only accrediting that NACEP-defined model, and it gets to be too much to consider all the different other pieces that a program might have under its belt. So just watch for that. Let us know if you find any questions there. One change that I hope you will find helpful this year is rather than the programs submitting their discipline and course list as part of this program description and then letting you all as the review team have to decide if that seems appropriate, we went ahead and asked for that in January when the programs were submitting their intent to apply. And so then the commission looked those over and went back and asked for some reorganization in some cases. And so hopefully what this will do for you is kind of relieve you of the burden of saying, well, gosh, is 10 disciplines enough for this size of a program? Over the years, it's basically come down to that the disciplines and the courses are at a 4-to-1 ratio. And so that's what we kept in mind as we looked at these. We also looked at the content areas. Was it odd if, you know, these disciplines were together? Or if the bulk of their courses are in English, you know, should we ask for that to be a separate discipline? So you may see some discipline lists submitted that don't necessarily completely reflect the way that the college or university structure is laid out, but part of that had to do with trying to combine approaches and make sure that we were using that definition of discipline that's in the NACEP handbook, but also looking at where are the numbers. If, you know, are we putting too many things together? Are we not putting enough things together? What is a reasonable sized application? Our reaccreditation application involved 18 disciplines, and I can tell you from a reviewer and a program perspective, that's a lot. That's a lot to go through. So right now we still ask for one per discipline, but we tried to help you with a little bit of advance work there on how many disciplines you'd be looking for. So, and there are several places throughout the application, as you all might remember, in the curriculum, faculty, and assessment standards where we do ask for one piece of evidence per discipline. So this discipline list in the program description, those numbers should be reflected throughout the entire application. That's something that your coordinating commissioner will be watching for when they screen, but again, just good to be aware of. Next slide. On the program description, I just thought this was a helpful hint. Rather than having to go back and constantly open it, if you want to just go ahead and type in some things in a comment box on your review form to help you remember what are the disciplines that they're referring to, that way it keeps you from having that particular form open. You're going to have a lot of documents open, as you know, so you've got to figure out a system that works best for you. Okay. I am ready to start on the curriculum standards, and you all are using that question box down there to its fullest extent, so we'll just keep on going. So there are three curriculum standards, and the intent of – oh, I'm sorry. Let me just kind of talk about how we're going to cover the standards. So on each slide, the standard is listed along with the required evidence. Some of the required evidence has three or four components, and so it bleeds over onto a second slide. So don't panic if you expect to see something and don't. There's also sometimes a required evidence statement that says additional evidence may be submitted, but we have omitted that from the presentation just for the sake of brevity. So I will summarize the intent of each standard and then talk about some common issues that happen when reviewing. If you all have anything to add, please do chime in. We've got as many relevant issues and veteran reviewers on this program or on this call as we possibly could. So I appreciate your feedback. So the intent of the Curriculum 1 standard is simply to confirm that the CEP courses are listed identically in the college catalog and routinely offered on campus. So we want to make sure that the courses are, the list of courses are publicly available, that the program descriptions match. Some folks will of course, give you a college catalog or a link to the college catalog. So if there are differences in the descriptions that relate to prerequisites, those should be addressed in the student standard. One of the issues that's come up in this last year, actually, with the programs both under review and who are just simply accredited members, is what does it mean when we say that the course should be offered on a regular basis? And that's phrasing found on page 13 of the guide. So we've had some conversation about that in commission calls. And, you know, what does it mean for a concurrent enrollment program to be offering a course that's not regularly offered on campus? Is there a benefit to that? So there's nothing that's really been stated in black and white by the commission or by NACEP saying that, you know, if a course hasn't been offered on your campus for 2 years, then you need to pull the plug in your program. Well, we all know it's a little more complicated than that. High schools building their schedules around it, and things on campus can pick up after, you know, things ebb and flow with enrollments. So, again, looking at that holistic picture is probably a good way to approach that. Okay. Under Curriculum 2, the intent of this standard is simply to have the institution affirm that within each discipline, the pedagogical, theoretical, and philosophical orientation of the courses is equivalent to that of on-campus courses, or the concepts, theories, and methods, and skills the same. So NACEP provides a standard form for the assessment and the C2 standards, and as Adam mentioned, it could be posted in one of a couple places on Box. It could be inside the assessment folder, or it may also be within the C2 folder. So either way is fine. If a program wants to cover all their bases and put it in all the folders, that's okay. So for veterans, thinking ahead to maybe your own reaccreditation, just a word here about this particular form. It's okay if a program wants to have standard language and have the liaisons or mentors sign off. It's also okay if they want to leave that up to the individual person who's completing the form to let them specialize it to their area. So if you're thinking ahead to your own reaccreditation, this is just a tip that we picked up on, that letting your liaisons fill out the form themselves is a really great way to gauge how well they understand their involvement in your program. What do they think they're supposed to be doing? What are they doing? That is all very helpful. So, but we don't ding these applicants if they have a standard response and then had folks sign off on it. We're supposed to be trusting that they agree with that statement by signing the form. So, but of course, when it's above and beyond, that does get your attention, and that's okay. Under then Curriculum 3, we have the faculty site visits. So the intent is to provide an opportunity for collegial interaction between the CEP instructor and somebody, a faculty member from the campus, from that discipline. They are there to observe course delivery, to verify that the college syllabus is being followed, and to listen to the student discourse and see what kind of rapport the instructor has in the classroom. There should be one site visit form for each discipline. And we have had some questions about the signatures, because it does say in the required evidence, completed and signed faculty site visit form. So we are okay with electronic signatures. Really, the most important part is that the faculty are the ones producing the report. So if you're seeing language that makes you question that, then it would be appropriate to bring up the fact that nobody from the faculty has signed the forms. But most of us are conducting these site visit transactions electronically, in terms of, here, I'm going to send you the form, you take it to the visit, you fill it out electronically, you shoot it back to me in an email. So if you want to, you know, go further than that, then just kind of think through it from that big picture perspective. But for those of you who are veterans, you might recall that in the revisions to the standards several years ago, we inserted the word faculty. So there could possibly be a program who got a hold of an older version of standards and isn't sending out their faculty, and that's going to be a big problem, because it does require, we are requiring that the faculty make the site visits. Other common mistakes that you may have seen come up if there is no tracking system or frequency requirement for those site visits, that needs to be in place. Perhaps the program doesn't have a standard site visit form. Sometimes faculty aren't great at completing it with a lot of language that's very helpful to program administrators. And so there could be some opportunity, if you've had success in getting your faculty to be more forthcoming, there could be some opportunity to brainstorm some things with your program that's under review. And then if there's minimal or no description of the feedback or follow-up process, especially if the liaison notes that there's a problem on the form. So I think it's generally safe to assume that the applicant has selected their best examples of site visit forms. If you see problems, then it's worth asking them about, you know, what did you do for Mr. Smith from North High School, for example, because you're going to have issues crop up, and they, part of this accreditation process is knowing that they have a procedure in place to deal with that. Okay. There are no questions, or, you know, if anybody wants to include some perspective on challenges they've had in the C standards, please jump in on the message board. Otherwise, we'll move on to the faculty standards. And if something comes back to you later, please throw it up there. It doesn't matter if we're on a different standard or a different slide at that point. So there are four faculty standards, you know, and the first one, F1, the intent is to verify that the instructors in the CEP meet the departmental requirements, and to verify who is doing the approving and the denying. So, of course, the approving and denying is coming from the academic department, not the principal or the CEP office, and that the instructors are aware of the responsibilities through some kind of an approval letter. We are going to be trying to catch confidential information that should not be put out there, like social security numbers, home addresses. Programs are asked to redact that information, and sometimes things slip through, so hopefully that won't be the case. And then the rest of the Faculty 1 standard is on the next slide. And so there are three pieces of required evidence under this particular standard. We don't require that the individual who was denied have their application submitted. It's just the denial letter. But if a program hasn't denied someone, this should be described in the cover sheet or somewhere. How the program would handle a denial if it occurred. And then I think you would also want to know why there hasn't been a denial. Is it because there's a pretty hefty pre-approval screening process, or is it because everyone is approved? And so, you know, just some things to consider there. In terms of that denial letter, this is something that I've been thinking about recently, and you all as veteran reviewers might have seen this before. I remember being on a review once where it wasn't a denial letter, it was a denial email. And there was some discussion among those of us who were reviewing about whether or not that was appropriate. And as time has gone on, I've started to think that that might be more okay. I've actually had teachers say, don't bother to send me a hard copy of a denial letter, because they want to know as soon as possible, and they don't want to wait around for the Postal Service, or they don't want anything like that created. I'm not sure, but to me it does seem like we do often have those transactions by email once we've heard back from whoever it is on campus who's making that decision. So I guess that's just something I've been thinking about, is that okay to have a denial email? Is that, are we now informal enough that that is formal enough? You know, so English professors, ponder, let me know. Faculty standard 2 is the intent of this one, is to confirm that new instructors are receiving course-specific training that prepares them to teach the course, and they're receiving that training from a faculty member in the discipline. It's also here to confirm that the instructor is receiving orientation to the policies of the program. So this standard and the next one, F3, are extremely important to the accreditation process, and they are the ones that trip up programs the most in terms of how they are documenting their professional development. So we do not have a minimum number of contact hours defined. Training can be done in small group settings or one-on-one. Your documentation that you would be receiving would probably differ a little bit depending on how the F2 training is structured. The training materials that are submitted as evidence should be discipline-specific and not just the materials used to orient to the policies of the program. And the next slide continues the F2 required evidence. So the second piece of required evidence mentions attendance reports, agendas, et cetera. We do show a screenshot of a sign-in sheet, but that is not actually required, a sign-in sheet per se. Some kind of attendance report is adequate. Not everybody, you know, has a means to collect the signatures, so please don't get hung up on those. This one is, like I said, often trips up programs. Does anybody have any comments about their experiences reviewing F2? It's important to note that we're only asking for two of the discipline-specific materials here out of the more than two disciplines that a program will have. So this is really just a small sampling of what's going on. And so because of that, I feel like it's okay if you have a lot of questions in this area. It's often very difficult for programs to describe what they're doing, and that means that you may have more questions as a review team. Okay.
I think one thing that I've seen on a few reviews that as veterans you may keep an eye out for is often programs will only have a handful of new instructors in any given year, and it may be there's only one in a particular course or subject area. And so I think sometimes if it's not obvious how the size and scale of their program, this is an area that's worth asking clarifications about. You know, just how many new instructors did you train last year? How many new did you have for each course? Because often programs that are newer to NACEP get F2 and F3 interchanged. They may even run professional development events concurrently. And so finding clarity on how many new instructors were trained and how they were treated differently than veteran instructors is important.
Thank you. Yes, that's a great point. Okay, Diana has a question. If a chair or liaison meets one-on-one with a new faculty member, do you need an agenda? And so there are a couple of different options under that required evidence. An agenda seems like a more viable option for a one-on-one meeting or minutes as opposed to an attendance report. I don't think I've ever seen a one-on-one, I signed into this one-on-one meeting with the chair. But I think more importantly would be, I guess maybe that agenda. I'm just looking at the other page here where we're talking about the training materials that are discipline specific, and then also your attendance reports or agendas. Sometimes the discipline specific materials are the ones that come from the chair. And then the attendance reports and agendas could be what we call here our new instructor orientation, where they meet with me and learn about the program and how to sign up their students and drop add dates and that sort of thing. So I think it just can vary. So then the next question is, will an email documented meeting and the information covered work? I know in F3 we allow for minutes. And no one has ever said minutes can't be emailed. I don't think that email would work for the first piece of required evidence, Diana. I think you could accept it under, well, I don't know. Jump in. What do you guys think? I guess it really just depends on the level of detail. I've seen emails that get extremely in-depth about what they discussed and with the content, but I've also seen ones that have been tried to pass off as item one that were not, they didn't get in-depth enough, and I wasn't comfortable with that. So I do think it just varies. It depends on a lot of those factors.
Yeah, I think as Diana and others are chiming in now on the email, on the chat window, I think there's two things that you're trying to demonstrate here. One is that the professional development occurs, that there is faculty in the discipline who are providing an orientation to the course, syllabi, assessment methods, pedagogy, and the like. And so
certainly an emailed agenda or a summary of a meeting can document that pretty effectively. The other aspect of this is, you know, what is it that they are actually doing in the way of training and orientation materials? And so it may be that the email describes what occurred and then a copy of the materials that were shared. Did they share sample syllabi? Did they share test banks, question banks for assessments or sample assignments and the like? So I think there's some materials that would probably need to go in addition to just the email sort of documenting that the meeting occurred and what was discussed, but then also some of the materials that were shared during that meeting.
Absolutely. Okay. We are ready for F3. So F3 is the other biggie, and this is the other biggie that happens annually, the annual discipline-specific PD. So the intent of the standard is threefold. First of all, you want your CEMP instructors interacting regularly with your campus faculty. You want to keep them informed as changes are made to content philosophy or assessment. And then you want to also engage the instructors in the academic community. And I think that last one is the one that the instructors really appreciate. They feel, at least in Indiana, teachers are feeling very underappreciated right now. And so when they are involved in our program, it really kind of helps them keep their heads up. And so I think it's important to really make sure that the instructors feel, you know, appreciated and respected. But that's a sidebar. So some key points about this particular standard, that the annual PD activities are distinct from the F2 new instructor orientation. The activities should be discipline specific, and new and returning instructors should be attending these activities. Smaller programs may say that they're conducting the annual professional development during faculty site visits. And so because this has been mentioned enough, there are some commentary items in the accreditation guide about it. I will say, though, that it's extremely difficult for programs to document this well if they choose to facilitate F3 during the C3 site visits. And I'm not sure why that is. It could be just the confines of the school day and there's not very much time. But what we have asked is for folks who are compressing this and doing their F3 and C3 at the same time, that the faculty liaison, the site visitor, the mentor, whoever, whatever you call that faculty member, that they're documenting the site visit and the PD separately. So there's the observation visit, and then there's the portion of the day where you sit down and chat through what are some changes in the discipline, what are some changes on campus, and maybe even let's talk about what just happened in your classroom. So I don't know if anybody feels like they do this well and can share some tips with the rest of us, but we are actually always looking for someone who is doing this well to help guide some of our newer programs who we see coming through the ranks. So, but it does happen, and so we need to be prepared for those types of applications. Methods of this meeting this standard can vary from traditional to non-traditional lecture or presentation. There could be journal article discussion. There could be brainstorming. There could be hands-on lab activities. It just depends on your discipline and your liaison. So the evidence that is submitted should document implementation, not simply an invitation to attend. Not happening face-to-face is acceptable if there's documentation that the activities are ongoing, robust, meaningful, and interactive. And there's more about that in the guide. There is a second slide for this standard that talks about tracking and ensuring the professional development participation. And so that's another common issue that comes up is trying to understand the tracking system that the program has in place or encouraging them to somehow make it a little bit cleaner and neater and easier for somebody from the outside to be able to read those items. So I've recently had a couple of conversations with folks who've asked if a graduate course can count as F3 annual discipline-specific professional development. And after discussion it seemed like, well, of course, you know, we want to be encouraging teachers to take coursework in their discipline. That's excellent and, you know, should always be encouraged. And so what we said was, gosh, that seems like a great idea. If the academic department is okay with it, you know, if it's relevant to the concurrent enrollment course, absolutely. But that taking that course should not be the regular F3 professional development. The course cannot substitute for that face-to-face conversation with faculty. And so perhaps, you know, every once in a while it can serve as that for somebody who's not able to attend the regular event. But I wasn't comfortable with saying that it was okay to just take graduate courses every year as part as your only PD. Because as we mentioned earlier, the point of this standard is that you're connecting your faculty in your program with the faculty on campus and making sure that they're up to date on the course itself. And you can't do that if you're off taking a graduate course and never interacting with that faculty member or that department. Okay, there's a couple of questions on the side. One's from Sandy. How do you feel about programs that indicate professional development for the instructors that was not given by the institution? For example, maybe a conference or seminar was attended with or without the assistance or guidance of the CEP program. So that does happen. There's a seminar on how to use a vernier probe, for example, for one of your chemistry teachers. And I think the key words there would be that the department who would normally hold the PD is the one saying, yes, this would be great, this is applicable, you should go. So making sure the department is involved in that decision. And then also that it's at a collegiate level, that this is not a K-12 conference, but that this is really aimed at someone who's teaching in the post-secondary, the higher education realm. Susan is asking, can program instructors use professional development they received at a workshop they attended for PD hours if they send the college documentation? And again, I think those same things apply. I can't sit here and give you a hard and fast answer for every single scenario because as soon as I do, there's going to be some exception that pops up. But I think the idea is that you want to know what are they regularly doing for their instructors, and then if there's these kind of interesting exceptions that happen, is that because their faculty member just doesn't want to meet with the high school teachers, or is it because there really was this awesome opportunity and they worked with them to find it and send them and approved it as this would be helpful for you to teach this course? So I think kind of weighing that big picture view is pretty important. That didn't answer your question, the two of you, please type on.
I think okay. I will point out that there is a little bit in the accreditation guide some commentary on this as well. And yes. You know, we do see this most frequently in cases where you have just one or a few instructors in a particular course or a particular discipline. And rather than the college running a workshop, they utilize some another opportunity, whether it's a professional association in the disciplines conference or some specific training that's happening in the field. And so, you know, as Jacqueline says, to some degree, it's sort of circumstantial. You sort of can see it making sense when you've got only one faculty member in the discipline for them to go ahead, as Sandy described, you know, sort of attend a conference or a seminar together with the assistants. And I do think the faculty liaison's involvement in the decision about that is critical to, you know, sort of essentially showing that the college's academic side of the house is making the decision about where what constitutes annual professional development.
Great question. Thank you, everyone. F4 is the last faculty standard, and this is, quote, new when the standards were revised in 2010. But it deals with whether or not there's a non-compliance policy, and this has to do not only with participation in the professional development activities, but also the curricular instruction piece, too. So we are not trying to confirm that a program has decertified an instructor. It's okay if the program gives instructors a second chance. But the idea is that the instructor is aware of the policy. So I think this is resoundingly okay if it wasn't part of the original application. I won't say resoundingly. It's not a showstopper. If this is like the one standard that, okay, we can help you craft this as long as you get it out to your instructors and start using it from here on out. It's not the end of the world if this one wasn't the greatest when you got the application. Other things, more of a problem. Okay, it's Adam's turn to talk about the student standards.
Thanks, Jacqueline. I'm cognizant of time, and the student standards in many ways are comparatively straightforward compared to some of the other standards. So if I rush through anything that you wish we could go into any further detail, please do pipe up on the chat window. So student one is really, the intent behind this is to confirm that registration policies and practices are consistent with on-campus policies. And to confirm that concurrent enrollment students are receiving college transcripts and that these courses are being transcripted as other courses from the college are transcripted. Every institution classifies concurrent enrollment students according to the policies of that institution. They may fall in a variety of different ways in which they are registered categories within their own internal data system. What is critical from the NACEP perspective with regards to this standard is that students are registered for the course at the time they enroll in the course, at the beginning of the course, and not are retroactively awarded credit later on after the course is completed, or allowed to try out a course for the entire semester and then registered at the very last minute in order to receive a grade. We want the timeline of add, drop, withdrawals, audits, things like that to be as consistent as possible with the policies for on-campus students. And so this is really, you know, we're putting the request for evidence here on the registrar to write a letter verifying compliance with this standard. Sometimes we see programs submitting sample transcripts for students. If you think that would be helpful, certainly you should feel free to ask for that. Likewise, if it's vague about what the add, drop, withdrawal, registration deadlines and policies are, go ahead and ask for additional clarification and information on this one. Again, the goal here is consistency. You're never going to see exact mirrors and matches because timelines and schedules are different. Student Standard 2 talks about prerequisites, and this is one that, again, is very dependent on the institution in terms of what types of prerequisites they have for courses. For most 100-level courses, there typically are not a lot of prerequisites. That being said, many colleges, in particular community colleges, have placement exams that they use to determine at what level a student can register in a different course. So at what level of math are they eligible to register for? If that placement exam is in place, then on campus, then it needs to be in place for the concurrent enrollment students as well. Likewise, if you're taking the second in a sequence of courses, if the first in a sequence of courses is a prerequisite to taking that second course, you shouldn't be offering that second course to high school students who have not yet completed the first course. So the process by which implementing prerequisite requirements should be described in this, and you really want to know what it is that the college or university is using to verify that students have met prerequisites before taking a course. Many programs will report here on state student eligibility standards. If they're in a state where there is a flat requirement for student eligibility into any course, in the case of this standard, what we are more concerned about is course eligibility. What are the prerequisites for the course, rather than necessarily are they required to have a 3.0 GPA in order to take any course? With regards to student standards 3, a comprehensive publication can take many forms. Many programs, as we've discussed earlier in some of the chats, are moving towards more electronic media for many processes, and particular students are very comfortable in the electronic space. And so
what is considered to be a publication may include a series of documents on a website. It may be one single PDF. It may be a website specifically for students. What is critical here is that that students are accessing the information, that it's not just put up on a website and then students are expected to discover it on their own, that they are provided either orally or through messages. The links to these websites, the information contained within them. Some programs utilize, presentations out in the high school saying, okay, you've enrolled in this course, and here are the rights and responsibilities of you as a student in this course, and then point them to web pages that they may access it. And in some cases, programs do print up a student guide and hand it to each and every student. So, the means by which students access that information is determined by the program, and what we're looking for typically here is that that the program specifically addresses the rights and responsibilities of concurrent enrollment students, because often if they're just handed a student handbook for a regular matriculated college student, there's a lot of materials in there that wouldn't necessarily apply or are different for them, and so how students are made aware of their specific responsibilities as a concurrent enrollment in students is critical. So I've just zipped through student standards very quickly, and there's a little bit of dialogue going on about student eligibility questions, and certainly go ahead and refer to the chat window for that. With that, I think I will turn it back over to Jacqueline to take on assessment.
Okay, and again, being mindful of time, we're going to keep this short and sweet. Yours too, the program students. We are trying to affirm that they are held to the same standards of achievement, held to the same grading standards, and assessed using the same methods as students in the on-campus sections. So to that end, we are looking for the paired syllabi from the on-campus and CEP sections. These should be actual syllabi and from the year under review, not just the templates or common course outlines. So that does come up pretty frequently. Comparing rigor, this is something that is best done point by point, pulling out both syllabi, and if you don't have a wide screen on your computer monitor, maybe ask your computer services department to bring you another one so that you can actually roll side by side through those syllabi. There's also the standard assessment form, which we've already kind of talked about, but that is also found in this particular area. And then on the next slide, we are talking about the detailed description of how the students are how you are assured that students are being held to the same standards of achievement. And I think as veterans, we can all say, yeah, that detailed description can vary quite a bit. The program may choose to put this on the cover sheet or even in a separate document. Either one is okay. But really, you're looking for the level of information that's being provided about what do they do to assure that the same learning expectations and outcomes are happening. And if you don't feel like enough information was provided, by all means, go back and ask them for some clarification or ask some more questions or make some suggestions. But if it's just a matter of what was on the cover sheet and I'd like to see it on a separate Word document, please don't create extra work for them to that nature, because they've been told it's okay to put it on the cover sheet. So in the next assessment, A2, we're talking about the grading standards. And the applicants will say that this happens, but you're looking for evidence that there's a process and a means by which the faculty engage the CEP instructors in this. Recommended supporting materials include grade comparison reports, descriptions of how the rubrics curves are conveyed to the instructors. You want to talk about, are there collaborative grading activities to norm grades? The English comp people love to do that sort of thing. History essays often are a topic for that as well. What does A work look like on campus compared to A work in the high school? So, and then the final assessment standard, talking about the methods. This is sometimes a sticky wicket here. We've got our required evidence. One says that paired student assessments or syllabi, one from each discipline for a side-by-side comparison. Within the guide and in the commentary, we do state that syllabi are allowable evidence, but if they don't include enough information for the review team to judge how equivalent the assessments are, reviewers can request sample paired assessments. So it doesn't have to be a completed test with, you know, student handwriting scribbled all over it. It can be blank. But you, as reviewers, if you don't feel like the syllabi have enough information, you can ask for something different in this area. And everybody is using the same guide, people who are putting together applications and people who are reviewing. So everybody has the opportunity to read that commentary. So your paired assessments that you're looking at, again, best if you can kind of pull them up side by side and look at them. Some colleges are a lot more prescriptive than other colleges, and I happen to be from a sort of non-prescriptive four-year public institution, and so mine can tend to look different. Instructors are allowed to create their own documents if the faculty liaison approves it. Other colleges, you're going to see the identical, you know, final exam for the two sections, and so you just kind of need to know the context of the program and the institution that you're looking at. The paired assessment should cover the same topics or concepts. So if you're doing, I don't know, stoichiometry, and that's the topic of the quiz that you got from the on-campus chemistry section, then it should be the same for the CEP section. The same assessment strategies should be used so that, you know, you're not seeing fill in the blank over on the left side and three short essays on the right. So those A standards all tie together. They are much more important than the time we were just able to give to them. Please contact us if you have questions. And Adam, on to you for the E standards.
Thanks. So program evaluation is one area that we find many programs have not engaged in very seriously prior to conducting their self-study and preparing an accreditation application. And so this is one area that, you know, is definitely a struggle for many of our programs. And with all of the evaluation standards, one of the required pieces of evidence is the survey instrument that is used. In the case of Evaluation 1, these end-of-term student course evaluations are typically the same ones that are used on campus, although it's not always that way. If they're using an online one, sometimes it'll be a little more difficult for them to provide you with a copy of the instrument, although certainly doing a screenshot or a PDF or a list of questions that were asked is one way of doing it. One of the things that is critical in this standard is that course evaluations are to be conducted for each course section offered through the concurrent enrollment program. So this is one of the common issues that comes up. Some campuses on campus, their policy may be to do it on a rotating cycle, maybe every second or third year for veteran instructors. With the NASIP standards for concurrent enrollment instructors, we are asking that you do every course every time it is taught. And so this may be an area where the concurrent enrollment program goes above and beyond the policies that are in place on campus. So that is one thing to keep an eye out. Again, if it's not clear from the materials that they've provided you, please do ask follow-up questions on that. And you know, it's always best to see how a program actually utilizes the results, how that information is shared with the appropriate individuals, such as the faculty liaisons and the instructors who are teaching the course. Let me move on to Evaluation 2. Evaluation 2 and Evaluation 3 are very similar. These are annual concurrent enrollment alumni surveys. The Evaluation 2 is for those who are 1 year out of high school, and Evaluation 3 is for students who are 4 years out of high school. The timeline for doing these is based upon when the students graduate from high school, not necessarily when they took the course. So if they took the course as a junior, they shouldn't be surveyed until they are 1 year after graduation from high school. So that's one of the common problems that we see in these alumni surveys. Is the sort of methodology used. again, the required evidence asks them to provide a description of the methodology. This is an area where we frequently see peer review teams asking additional questions. You know, just how did you administer the survey? Where, you know, what was the pool of students who were surveyed? How many of them responded? How did you follow up with them? How is the data analyzed and the findings from the analysis used to continue to improve the program? We don't have a minimum response rate for any of these surveys, but we do ask, you know, as I say, that the process for increasing response in terms of how when the survey is administered, how it's administered, and how non-respondents are followed up with is described. And so, and you should be looking for seeing what they've got in the way of process. Do they have an effective process for administering the alumni surveys? They are required to work with, according to the standard, a qualified institution evaluator or researcher. And so that may be someone on staff in the concurrent enrollment program if they've got somebody who's got experience doing survey work. It may be that they need to rely on someone else, such as a faculty member or an institutional research office. What they should be describing is who is involved and how they ensure that a qualified individual is participating. We don't require that it be one particular person wearing with a particular job title. With regard to Evaluation Standard 4, this is then a survey of the participating concurrent enrollment instructors, the principals of the schools, as well as the guidance counselors. Now, sometimes what we discover here is that programs don't have much prior contact with the principals or the guidance counselors at the schools. And so, you know, this is an opportunity in many ways for a program to expand their exposure with those individuals and to start building relationships with them who are critical to the long-term viability and success of the program. Again, the goal of this is to provide information for programs to utilize to inform the program as it strives to improve. The GACEP provides templates for the E2, E3, and E4 standards. The questions in those survey methods are required to be used in those survey templates. Programs are welcome to add to the questions that are in the NACEP essential questions, but they do at a minimum need to utilize the ones that have been presented as templates by NACEP. With the E4 surveys, sometimes the questions do vary between the three different populations, the teachers, the guidance counselors, and the principals. And so for those questions that vary, it's important that the programs do separate analyses. For questions that are common across them, they may wish to do some common analysis as well, but it is critical that they are looking at each of those pools separately as well. Usually we see better response rates out of these because they're more of a captive audience. And again, you're going to be looking for process and effective methodology. I see that we've reached our 90 minutes. There are still some questions coming in. And so, Jacqueline, I guess the question is, do you want to continue taking questions at this point or wrap things up and sort of continue by email?
I would say maybe we could just unmute, and if folks need to leave, let them leave. Otherwise, we can maybe talk with our voices. I'm okay staying on for a few more minutes.
Okay, so in case people start dropping off, thank you very much for attending today. Thank you very much for your commitment to program improvement through peer review accreditation. We appreciate all the volunteer work that you do for us. And please do, if you're coming to the conference in Chicago, plan to attend breakfast on Monday morning. That's on us as a way of saying thank you to you and for your continued service to NACEP. So we will go ahead and unmute the lines now and continue the conversation and questions for those of you who are available to stay on.